The Gospel to the Jews, the seventh talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy, was presented by Jack Crabtree on February 14, 2006, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right, we're at the section called The Gospel to the Jews. We'll look at that tonight. The reason this is, I think, a very interesting question, or a very interesting topic, is because if one doesn't really thoroughly understand what the Bible is doing, how it's doing what it's doing, it's very easy to get the impression that you have two entirely different and separate things going on. You've got the Jews who look at the Bible, what we call the Old Testament, and they have Judaism that seems to be grounded in the Old Testament on the one hand, and Christians have the Old Testament that we claim for our own as well as the New Testament. And we, for the most part, ignore the Old Testament and read the New Testament, and we have this whole other religion that we call Christianity that comes out of that. It seems to be grounded largely in the New Testament. Well, is it really that fragmented, or is the Bible actually speaking with one voice and giving us a unified picture of God and his purposes and what he's up to in reality? Well, as you can guess, my contention would be it's unified. It really is speaking with one voice, and there's one thing going on. But to understand how that's the case can get complex. So, particularly when you read, where it really becomes a problem is when you're reading, for example, through the Gospels, and you talk about Jesus and his disciples going out and proclaiming the gospel, proclaiming the good news. What they would have been proclaiming would in no way at all resemble what we would proclaim as Christians in our culture today. And yet, it's called the gospel. What's up with that? Is there one faith or is there not one faith? Is there one message or is there not one message? That's what I want to try to sort out by looking at what I'm calling the gospel to the Jews. To do that, we have to go back and kind of survey the history of God's dealing with the Jews throughout time in the course of the Old Testament. And for our purposes, it starts with this guy named Abraham. Abram was a Chaldean from the area that came to be Babylon, what is now modern-day Iraq. He came from Chaldea, was probably what we would consider a heathen, a polytheist, who believed in many gods and worshipped however many. The God, the Creator, appeared to Abraham and said, I'm going to give you a land, follow me, essentially. Go where I tell you to go. And then over the course of his life, Abram sort of wooed, or God wooed Abram to a recognition that he was the only God worth paying any attention to over the course of time. But I don't think that's where Abraham started, but that's where he ends up. He still is not where we are in his understanding of God. He isn't even where Moses got to in his understanding of God. There's a very interesting passage when God is talking, Yahweh appears to Moses on Mount Sinai, not the first time, I think it's the second time. He appears to God on Mount Sinai and he says, your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, your fathers knew me as El Shaddai, but you will know me as Yahweh. And El Shaddai, there's debate about how that's to be translated. A lot of them want to translate it God Most High, which makes sense to me. But I think whatever it means, I think the idea is Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob recognized that I was a big deal, but they recognized I was a big deal in the context of a largely polytheistic worldview. They hadn't sorted out that I'm not just the most important God, but I'm the only God in town. They that wasn't clear to them yet. But you will know me as Yahweh. And Yahweh, I think, I would translate it, following Aquinas, as he who is. Yahweh is he who is. And it's a simple statement, but a really profound statement when you stop to think about it. God is in a way that we isn't. We don't have being in and of ourselves. I don't have another nanosecond of my existence if God does not will it so. My very existence is contingent upon he who is willing it to be the case. But no one must will God's existence in order for him to go on living, because he is. He just is, period. And I think that's what's captured by the name Yahweh, he who is. Well, that's a quantum leap philosophically in their conception of God. When you get God revealing himself to Moses as Yahweh, you have jumped from one paradigm to an entirely different paradigm. From the paradigm of polytheism and belief in multiple gods to a paradigm of true monotheism, where there's really only one God who's the reality-shaping force behind all that is. Well, nonetheless, whether Abraham had a completely adequate view of God yet or not, nonetheless, God was dealing with him. The one who is Yahweh, the one who is the God who is, was dealing with Abraham. And essentially, I think, we can boil down his interaction with Abraham in terms of making two promises to Abraham, two sets of promises to Abraham. This is somewhat controversial, but I think this sure looks to me the way the apostles understand God's dealings with Abraham. One set of promises was about Abraham's physical descendants, what we would think of as the Jews today, people who are... it's largely biological descent, but it's not strictly biological descent, because if you look at the history of the Jews, there were Canaanites who came into the people within and became included in the people of Israel, Moabites, Jebusites, we don't even know what all of them were, but they intermarried and became a part of the people of Israel. Really, what's ultimately required to be a member of the people of Israel is not biological descent, but what's required is a willingness to be assimilated into the people of the covenant, the people who have a covenant with God, where God says, "I will be your God and you will be my people," which is the promise that he began with Abraham. He says, "I'm going to multiply your descendants. You're going to have a whole lot of grandchildren, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be their God, and they will be my people." And it's that promise that God made to Abraham that just sat there for hundreds of years, and God didn't do anything about it. He just made this promise and said it's going to happen. But God didn't do anything about it. We'll come back to that in a second. The other promise that I think he was making to Abraham was a promise of ultimate blessing. That's the very first thing Yahweh said to him. "Abraham, I will bless you, and in you all the peoples of the earth will be blessed." And that was not just a promise that pertained to the Jews, because he explicitly says all the peoples of the earth, all the families of the earth. It's a very cryptic and ironic statement, because I think what he means by "in you" is by being your children, all the people, those who are your children and those who are not your children, will be blessed by being your children. In effect, that's what the promise is. So it's this, it just teases you into the recognition that whatever God is up to in that promise, it's not only about the Jews, not only about the physical descendants of Abraham. There are a set of promises that pertain to the physical descendants of Abraham, but there's another set of promises that pertain to a larger, to all of mankind. Well, the apostles understand that blessing, as I would understand it, to be what they later identify as eternal life. Life in the age of ages, life in the final age. That's the blessing of blessings. And that's, as if you were here last week, that's the blessing that we were talking about last week in the gospel to mankind is this promise of life, life in the age of ages, to those who don't deserve it and are not worthy of it. Simply by the mercy and grace of God, God is granting it to whomever he wills. And that's the good news, because he's not going to hold my unworthiness against me. Well, that's one of the streams of promises that God made to Abraham thousands of years ago. Now, the other one, the one that pertained to the people who identify themselves as children of Abraham explicitly, as I said, for hundreds of years, God didn't do anything about that. But then they go into slavery, the Israelites go into slavery in Egypt, and after decades of slavery in Egypt, finally God acts. And by singling out his prophet Moses and sending Moses to lead them out of Egypt, the prophets describe that as their birth experience. The Exodus is when the people of God became the people of God. It had been promised that they would be the people of God, but God has not done anything to inaugurate that. But at the Exodus, he did. He went in and said, "You're my people. I'm going to take you now, put you back on the land that I promised you. You're going to be liberated from the Egyptians, and we're going to get on with this process of me being your God and you being my people." And immediately, he took them to Mount Sinai, where he drew up a covenant, a contract with them. So the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant is intimately connected with the Abrahamic Covenant. And if you have any question about that, just read through the book of Deuteronomy. It's just very clear. It was striking to me in looking at Deuteronomy how directly Moses is linking what's happening in his day with what God promised to Abraham several generations earlier. So the Mosaic Covenant is God coming along and saying to Israel, here is what it's going to mean to you to be my people. In order to be my people, here's the way I want you to behave, to conduct your life together, to live together in community. Here's the institutions that I want you to establish. I want you to eat funny. I want you to dress funny. I want you to be a peculiar people in many ways, as defined by the terms of this contract that I'm making with you today, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, he says, and in exchange, here's what it's going to be for me to be your God. I will prosper you in the land. I will protect you from the enemies. I'm going to do all this stuff for you if you decide to take this on and be my people. So that's the Mosaic Covenant. That's the part that we Christians today most don't understand. Because we look at the Mosaic Covenant and we think that the Mosaic Covenant is God's statement about how he wants every nation to work and to live. We all should be that kind of nation. We all should be that kind of people. But the fact of the matter is, that's not the case. Because the Jews are a special people in God's purposes and God's plan. God was calling them to a level of holiness that is beyond the reach of any other family on the earth. And you look at some of the provisions in Deuteronomy. If your neighbor blasphemes God, stone him to death. If your neighbor blasphemes God and you fail to stone him to death, you are to be stoned to death. Well, there wouldn't be any Americans left, you know, if we were to institute those sorts of policies. Why so stringent? Why so harsh? Why so exacting? Because you were stoning them to death because they were to be a holy people. They needed to literally purify their society, purify their culture, purify their people, that they might be a holy people. Is it humane? Absolutely not. Because what God is doing in this experiment that he wanted to conduct among his people was not an experiment in humanity and in freedom. It was an experiment in holiness. And so he demanded absolute, complete, unbending, inflexible commitment to God. there were going to be believers and only believers. And if you were not a believer in their midst, you would eventually be purged. Because that was the nature of the experiment that he was conducting. Well, as it happens, they never took it on. They never did keep their part of the bargain. But the prophets come along and say, well, you didn't keep your part of the bargain, but God has not forsaken you nonetheless. Even though you haven't kept your part of the bargain, God still remembers the commitment, the promise that he made to your father Abraham. And God will keep that promise. And there's a Hebrew word that you see over and over again in the prophets. It's chesed. God is a God of chesed. And it's hard to translate that, but it's basically an idea of God is a God who is faithful to keep the promises that he's made to other people. What he requires of his people is chesed, and the way he interacts with the people of Israel is with chesed. And his chesed is going to be vindicated in the final analysis. It may take thousands of years. It may take multiple thousands of years. But after multiple thousands of years, the day is going to come where God is going, because of God's chesed, he's going to come and be faithful to his people and keep his promises to them. Now, how is he going to do that? The promise gets made all the way back in Deuteronomy. I mean, if you read the end of Deuteronomy, Moses says, he tells you, I'm giving you these ordinances and these statutes and these judgments today for you to follow them so that you might go into the land and prosper. And it's immediately followed by, you know what's going to happen? You're going to go into the land, and God is going to give you vineyards that you didn't plant, and cisterns that you didn't dig, and houses that you didn't build. And you're going to drink from the cistern and eat from the vineyard and live in the house, and you're going to say in your heart, I planted that vineyard, I dug that cistern, I built that house, and you're going to forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. That's what's going to happen. And then what's going to happen is God is going to judge you. And he's going to take you into captivity for 70 years. He even predicts the time that they're going to be gone. He's going to take you into captivity for 70 years. Then he's going to bring you back in the land. And he goes on and he says, but the day is going to come when the Lord is going to circumcise your heart that you might know him. And I can't remember how it gets phrased. But the way in which God is going to be faithful is he's going to reach into the lives of some generation of the descendants of Abraham and Israel. He's going to reach into their hearts and circumcise their heart so that instead of being what the Old Testament calls a stiff-necked and rebellious people, they are going to be a people who want to know God and who want to honor God and who want to serve God. Well, I would contend that day has never happened yet. The Jews as a people, as a whole culture, have not yet come to the point where they want to serve God. But it's going to come. Paul is looking forward to that in the book of Romans. I think that's predicted by Moses in Deuteronomy. It's predicted by Jeremiah. It's predicted by Isaiah. I mean, the prophets are full of this prediction of this day that's going to come. They call it the great and terrible day of the Lord, which is going to be a very, very momentous day in the life of the people of Israel, where it's going to be fisher cut bait time, and they at that point are going to be sorted out, and the only ones that will survive are those who believe God and who are ready to serve him. At which point, something like the Mosaic Covenant, I think, is going to literally be instituted in the land by the Jews living in the land, and they are in fact going to obey the covenant just as they said they would, their forefathers said they would back at Mount Sinai. That's the Mosaic Covenant. In the meantime, they didn't keep the Mosaic Covenant right away. They went into the land. They were judged by various prophetic type figures called judges. And one day they want a king. And God gives them a king. And then he deposes Saul, who was their first king, and puts in his place this little shepherd boy named David, makes him king. David at one point wants to build God a temple, and God sends the prophet Nathan to David saying, no, you're not going to build me a house. You're not going to build me a house, I'm going to build you a house. And he makes this incredible prediction. He says, I'm going to establish your throne forever and ever. Your throne will go into perpetuity. And he describes Solomon, who's going to be the next king after David on the throne. He says, I will be a father to him, and he will be a son to me. And thus comes into being the concept of the Son of God. And we'll talk about that more in the very next section when we talk about the titles of Jesus. So I won't get into that right now. But establishing this person who's going to be on the throne, being the very embodiment of the authority of God himself in a human person. So God's authority, God's reign, God's rule is going to be embodied in a human being. And that human being is the son of David, the king of Israel, who's going to be the embodiment of God's rule. Well, that's another strand of the promises that God has made to the people of Israel. You not only have God being God and they being his people, but you also have God being their God in the form, embodied in the form of a human being who's the very locus of that authority and the embodiment of that authority. So when that kingdom is going to be established, it's going to be ruled over by the Son of David. Okay, then you have the New Covenant, and I've already alluded to it, but the phrase the New Covenant comes out of Jeremiah, what is it, 30, 31, 32, something like that, somewhere. Where he says, in the last days, I'm going to make a covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with your fathers, for they didn't keep it. I can't remember how he puts it. So the difference that he's pointing out is that the forefathers had a covenant struck with them, but the forefathers weren't really interested in keeping that contract. But the day is going to come where God is going to make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And in that day, the house of Israel and the house of Judah are going to be interested in keeping it because God will have circumcised their hearts. As he puts it in Jeremiah, I will write my law on your hearts. And he talks about the forgiveness of their sins. And no one will need to be taught to know God, for they will all know him. That is, that from the inside out, the people of Israel will have been transformed. And having been transformed, they will be prepared to take seriously the Mosaic Covenant once again. Well, that's the New Covenant. Now, that's what gets really confusing to us as Christians, because Jesus talked about the New Covenant in his blood, and the New Covenant for the forgiveness of sins, and so on. And so we like to claim that for our own. But if you go back to the Jeremiah account, it's very clear that the new covenant is with the house of Jacob and the house of Israel. We Gentile dogs have no part of that in and of itself. But what the apostles do on a number of occasions is that they take Old Testament prophetic predictions that pertain to something that's going to happen in the history of the Jews, the history of the Israelites. They look at something like that, and what they notice is what's going to happen to the entire generation of Jews one day is beginning right now to already be given to a sprinkling of Gentiles. That's the logic, for example, behind on the day of Pentecost, if you remember that account. On the day of Pentecost, the Spirit is poured out. 5,000 people believe in that day. Now, those are not Gentiles. Those are Jews, but it's still not... So 5,000 people become believers that day after the Spirit has come upon the disciples that were gathered, and there's a sound like a rushing wind. There's flames of fire dancing over their head, and they're speaking in languages that they don't know supernaturally. That's the pouring out of the Spirit. And Peter looks at that and says, that's what Joel was talking about. Well, but if you look at it carefully, the Joel passage that Peter is talking about, there are many things in that Joel passage that are not happening on that day of Pentecost. So what does Peter mean when he says, this is what Joel was talking about? What he means is the coming of the Spirit of God on a people to open them up to truth, open their eyes so that they can see, open their hearts so that they can believe, which was happening on that day of Pentecost. Peter recognizes that's what's going to happen in the latter times to the people of Israel on that day when finally God comes and makes his covenant with them. They need to have the Spirit poured out in order for them to be the people of God. Well, these 5,000 people are having the Spirit poured out now in their lives. And we who are Gentile believers, we have had the Spirit poured out into our lives, yea, even now. So we have had a foretaste of what's going to transpire in the day when the Spirit of God is poured out on the whole house of Israel sometime in our future. They're going to be sanctified just like you and I are experiencing sanctification. But the prophets weren't talking about you and I. The prophets were talking about what's going to happen to the house of Israel. But we have experienced what they are going to experience. We have the crumbs off the table. We're out of the mainstream of the prophetic history. But nonetheless, what's happening in our life is a very glorious reality that is directly linked to what God is going to do in his own people. So that's the new covenant. The new covenant in Jeremiah talks about the forgiveness of sins. So that's why Jesus links what he's doing with the new covenant, because it's in Jesus' death on the cross, appealing to God for mercy on our behalf. That appeal to God for mercy was an appeal to God for mercy, not just for us Gentiles who believe, but for the entire people of Israel as well. So on that day when they come to believe, it's going to be on the basis of Jesus' death on the cross on their behalf. How could it be otherwise? And so Jesus sees directly the link between him shedding his blood on the cross and what Jeremiah was talking about as the forgiveness of sins in the New Covenant passage. Okay. So the relationship of the gospel to the Jews, to the gospel to mankind. Fundamentally, the gospel to mankind pertains to the last age, the age to come, when this heaven and earth passes away and God recreates a new heaven and earth. The gospel to the Jews pertains to events within this age, within history, the present age of this world. The gospel to the Jews involves and includes the promises and the blessings of the gospel to mankind. It includes that certainly. But it addresses itself only to the destiny of Jews, not commenting on Gentiles at all. So that's why Jesus can come in his earthly ministry to Galilee and Judah, proclaiming the gospel to Judea. And when he proclaims the gospel, he doesn't have you and I in view. He has in mind all these promises that God made to his people, the Jews. There's going to be the forgiveness of sins. There's going to be the granting of the blessing of Abraham, even though we are not worthy of it. Everything that I described last week as the gospel of mankind is directly relevant to all these Jews and more, and other things besides. But all of that, as it pertains to the Jews, is what he means by the gospel that he's proclaiming to them. My next point here is the gospel to mankind, what I described as the gospel to mankind, is a distillation of the gospel to the Jews, with those aspects that pertain uniquely and exclusively to the Jews eliminated. So I'm not looking forward one day. I mean, I find it exciting, but I'm not expecting one day that I will be a citizen in a kingdom with Jesus as king ruling over us in a society where everyone is a believer. That's a very remarkable idea and a very interesting thing that God is going to do in history, and I wish I could be there, but that's not part of my expectation. That's not part of my hope, because I'm not a Jew. The gospel to the Jews is most importantly the same thing as the gospel to mankind. It is just that it includes some elements that are uniquely relevant to the physical descendants of Israel. And then I add to that, the blessings and promises uniquely relevant to the physical descendants of Israel are relatively unimportant as compared with the blessings and promises that are relevant to all of mankind. So lest we Gentiles feel more cheated than we need to feel, the blessings that are going to come to the Jews are truly remarkable. And I think the story that is being played out among the Jewish people is a very, very exciting and interesting story. But when all is said and done, in the light of eternity, we are going to get everything of eternal importance. Those of us Gentiles who believe are also going to enter into the life that is the only thing that counts in the end. History is going to pass away, this world is going to pass away, and the special relationship that the Jews have to God is going to pass away with the passing away of this world. Some Christians think it has already passed away, but I don't think they're reading their Bible rightly. But certainly at the end of this world, it will pass away. And when it does, and we enter into eternity, there will be no Jew or Gentile there in eternity. That will be an irrelevant distinction at that point. Okay, you must have a ton of questions, so go ahead.
Why do you think that... That when we enter into heaven, there will be no distinction between Jew or Gentile. Is there a particular point of the Bible that backs that up?
Well, you do have Galatians where Paul says, in Christ there is neither male nor female, Jew nor Greek, slave or free, I think he says there. He's not really talking about eternity exactly right there, so that statement doesn't exactly answer your question. But what I would argue is the reason he says that is rooted in the same truth that's implicit in the gospel in the New Testament that I would extrapolate to the conclusion that in eternity there will be none of those things as well. You do have Jesus say that, for example, with respect to the male-female issue, that there in heaven there is no marriage nor giving in marriage. And that may very well be because we will no longer be sexually distinct beings in eternity. I don't know that, but that may be. So if he's eliminated the sexual difference in eternity, then it makes sense that he's eliminated all the other differences as well as have any real relevance or bearing on our relationship with God. Yeah?
I'm trying to fit all of what you're saying into the picture I've been taught as a kid about end time prophecy with the 7 years of tribulation and the millennium and how does what you're saying fit into that picture? When does Jesus come back? You mentioned the great terrible day of the Lord. Is Jesus coming back on that day? The society of Jews that have this new covenant and are a righteous society, will Jesus be here at that time? Or will there be a period of time where the Jews are living in that new covenant society before Jesus comes back? I'm having trouble.
Yeah. Well, when we start getting into prophecy, I just should just warn you right up front, and I'll only do it once, but you can remember about everything I say. I'm a student of the New Testament, and I haven't spent a lot of time in the Old Testament kind of digesting it. So everything I have to say has to be tested ultimately against a thorough study of the Old Testament, something that I have not been able to do. So my picture of Old Testament prediction is based on my understanding of what the New Testament says about that and how they seem to interpret it. I'm pretty confident of how I understand that they've interpreted it, but until I can test it by saying, yeah, that makes sense out of the Hebrew in this passage, I have to be a little bit tentative there. And maybe you can help me, Doug, because I think Doug has studied this more than I have. But my understanding, based on the New Testament at this point, is that our typical, you know, left behind, pre-millennial, pre-tribulation rapture kind of scenario, that doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think that's right. Ron helped me understand that when you look at the Matthew account and he talks about the Great Tribulation is from the perspective of what God is doing among the Jews. So the Great Tribulation began in about 70 AD when, I know this is not politically correct, but I think this is very biblically correct. God sent his son to his own people to be their king, and they rejected him and literally killed him. God's response to that was to chastise them. He's not rejecting them. He's not forsaking them. That's the message of the prophets throughout. God will never forsake them. His chesed goes to the thousandth generation. So he will never reject his people. But because they, in their stubbornness, in that first century generation of Jews, in their stubbornness and their unbelief and their hardness against the things of God, because they killed the son that he sent to be their king, God came in wrath to chastise them. And you have all the events around 70 AD were horrendous events. If you've ever read Josephus' account of the siege of Jerusalem, it was awful. It was just this awful, awful event, and Masada and the whole thing eventually. That was the beginning of a period of tribulation to the Jewish people that has lasted for thousands of years. And it includes the Holocaust, Nazi Germany. It includes the Russian pogroms. It includes some of the activities in the Inquisition in the Middle Ages. I mean, the Jews have been hounded and persecuted and chased and dealt with unjustly for thousands of years of Western history. And the picture you get in Revelation is it's like Satan is out chasing them to devour them and to destroy them, because they're the people of God, and he's out to destroy them. And Revelation gives the picture that there's two reasons that the Jews are scattered into the nations. One, because they're being chased by Satan, but secondly, they're scattered for their own protection. They're not all gathered together where they can be destroyed, and so they've been scattered across the world so that they could be preserved, better preserved, only to be gathered back again at the end. So instead of there being 7 years of tribulation, like the kind of standard prophetic scenario, there have been thousands of years of tribulation, and the tribulation has nothing to do with us Gentiles. It's tribulation for the Jewish people as the people of God. Strangely, ironically, that same period is, I think, the millennium. That 1,000 years where Satan has been cast into the abyss and imprisoned in the abyss, I think it happened, he was cast into the abyss with the coming of Jesus into the world. He's the prince of the darkness of the air. When the light came into the world in Jesus, it dispelled the darkness, if you will. Another metaphor would be Satan was locked up in the abyss to be kept for 1,000 years. It's not literally 1,000 years, it's just a really long time. Well, at the end of that really long time, it says he's going to be released again to go out and deceive the nations. Well, from the time of Jesus until this day, we've lived in a period of relative light, a relatively high degree of receptivity to the truth, vulnerability to the truth. I mean, when you think about the history of Christianity and how it spread, Christianity is one thing, authentic belief is another thing, but with the spread of Christianity, I think was also the spread of real authentic belief as well during that same time period. And the reason, I think, is because the deceptive powers of Satan have been curtailed during that time. But the time is going to come where he's going to be released, and he will probably throw the world back into the same kind of darkness that existed before Jesus came. And it was pretty dark. I mean, you look at the religious and philosophical ideas of the ancient world, they were clueless compared to us today. But I would think that that darkness is going to return again before it's all over. But that is going to affect, I think, the Gentile world. It's the Gentile world that's going to be cast into darkness. And somewhere around that time, God will have shifted his sanctifying work off of the Gentile world and return once again to his own people, the Jews, and is going to sanctify them. When that happens, I think, it's simply that they're going to become believers in Jesus. So I think the sense in which Jesus is going to rule over them as king is in the same sense that he rules over you and I as king right now. I don't think he will be physically present here. I think he's just going to... They are now going to believe and live their lives in the light of his authority over their lives. So that will go for a while, and then I think it'll go right up. It looks to me like it's going to go right up until the end of the world, and then the world is going to explode with a bang, and then we start all over with a new heavens and a new earth. But like I say, there could be a lot of missing pieces in that. Did I leave anything on?
No, I think that answered my question. I was thinking, as you kind of wrap that up, how long this period of the new covenant with the Israel will last. But
yeah, I don't think we have any good clues about that. But like at the end of Joel, when you look at the end of Joel, there's this monumental event that has happened, where there's the recognition of Jesus, and it probably includes that. And then you have this passage that goes on talking about prosperity in the land, and the people who had enslaved them will now become their slaves. And so it gives the appearance of an ongoing culture and life and civilization for a while, but I don't know how long. Michael?
So first off, is that 1,000 Jews? Would you say that it's already started and it's going in some time, or is it to happen?
I think it started with the coming of Jesus and the teaching of the apostles. That was the dawning of the light, and so the imprisoning of Satan and the beginning of the 1,000 years where he's imprisoned in the abyss, I think, begins somewhere around then. My fear is that we are seeing the twilight of that time, because there's a kind of unprecedented kind of confusion falling over world cultures today. We're not even sure we believe in the concept of truth any longer, let alone that Jesus is the truth. And that seems to be almost unprecedented in world history, that level of hostility against God. We're so hostile to God that we're not even going to admit that there is such a thing as a concept of truth. May be a harbinger of the end of the time of light. It may be that the powers of darkness have begun to go out to the nations and deceive the nations. But I don't know. I ain't no prophet, so I don't know.
What you've been saying is really interesting to me from the perspective that, I mean, for some time I've been dwelling on the issues of the relation of covenants and scripture, and specifically the histories of covenant theology, federalism, and that history as far as the more Reformed tradition goes, or dispensationalism. I'm trying to think about, like, which side am I really on? Like, or is there a side to be on? Or is there a new side? You know, or those different things. Where's Jack in all this mess? You know, it's very complicated.
Yeah, I'm rejecting both.
But I think it's interesting so far as, from what I've heard you say tonight, other times, it seems like you're pulling from common themes in both, and then rejecting things in both of them.
Right, exactly. Right.
to the extent to which covenant theology emphasizes a strong theme of God's grace throughout both the Old and New Testaments, you seem to be in agreement with that.
Yeah.
You don't think that Jesus is coming along and rejecting the Old Testament outright, or that Paul is coming along and replacing, you know, a faith salvation as opposed to the Old Testament Jewish works salvation kind of system. So you're sort of in agreement with covenant theology there, insofar as you see a unity between those perspectives. And but at the same time, you're not in agreement with covenant theology's replacement theology. You know, so you don't see Paul coming along and rejecting the Jews as such. Like, in other words, there's not this transformation of the physical Israel to the spiritual church, that covenant. So that your agreement is on the continuity of grace.
Right.
Your disagreement is with a replacement theology. You still see a place for Israel in God's plan. And that's something which dispensationalists emphasize a great deal. There's this continuity of Israel alongside the church. Or at least there will be a continuity. At least they see a plan for God for a future, you know, coming back to Israel, like we're talking about. And so it seems like on that level of acknowledgement of Israel, there's agreement there as well. And I'm not sure if dispensationalists really believe this, but there seems to be some speaking about kind of idea that I'm just confused on how they see faith and grace. And I mean, in relation to the Old Testament, I don't really understand them. But
the old-time hardcore, the reason I have a problem with dispensationalism is the view that there have been different discrete dispensations throughout history. It's a theology that started with the dispensation of what? Innocence? Dispensation of, I don't remember any longer.
Yeah, innocence.
And the two main ones are the dispensation of law in the Old Testament, the Mosaic Covenant, and today the dispensation of grace. The old-time hardcore dispensationalist saw these as airtight, discrete games that God was playing with mankind. And you certainly get the impression, reading some of the original dispensationalists, that if I seek to be justified by law here and now today, my only problem is I was born too late. That if I had been born before Christ, I'd be perfectly appropriate to live the way that I'm living. But alas, I was born too late. I'm in a different dispensation, so I have to play by different rules now. Well, that's crazy, I think. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't make any sense out of the way any of the apostles look at the Old Testament and look at salvation and the nature of salvation and how salvation works. The idea that God is kind of playing different games at different times and changing the rules on us is not the way they're looking at it. Where dispensationalism got a lot of things right is they insisted on a literal interpretation of the Bible. Take it literally unless you can't, basically.
So a rejection of the early church fathers, kind of interpretation.
Typology and all that kind of highly symbolic. And I must confess, although they're too extreme in that regard, in that they... they don't even really mean that, because they recognize symbol and metaphor and all that kind of stuff. But what they were really trying to get at is the covenant theologians, who were ready to make anything into a symbol anytime, anywhere, were doing that because they were intent on seeing the church as being now the new people of God. It used to be the Jews were the people of God. They rejected God, so God transferred his allegiance over to the church, and we are now the people of God, we who are believers, Jew and Gentile together in the church. Well, I was very intrigued by that idea for a long time, but the more I've studied Romans and his argument at the end of Romans, and especially chapter 10, 11, it just doesn't work. Paul, the whole idea of God's chesed, he doesn't forsake them just because they don't believe. Just because they reject him, God's not going to reject them. Covenant theology also has this insistence on God started over and did this new religion called Christianity that parallels the old religion of Judaism. So they circumcised their children, we baptize our children. They had the Passover, we have the Lord's Supper. And it's just a manner of piecing together fragments of the biblical picture that is not really derived from the Bible. It's kind of imposed on the Bible. And they like the symmetry of that, but unfortunately it has nothing to do with anything the apostles were saying. That's not how they were thinking about it, I don't think. So that's my problem, both the replacement theology, the idea that we have replaced Israel as the people of God, and their view of religion and the role of religion in our life and our faith as Christians, I think is wrong.
Your view is, and I put it this way, is it doesn't break things up according to time period. I mean, in both covenant and dispensational theology, it's almost a time period. It's like, it's a certain time period for the old covenant, and a certain time period for, you know, for the church, the new covenant as such. Or maybe I'm using the wrong terminology. But it seems to place a lot of emphasis on time frame, and yours seems to put a lot of emphasis on covenant in terms of there's the God who created Adam. Adam, you know, fell and disobeyed God and fell into the condemnation of disobedience. And out of that, God was willing to be forgiving towards those who believed him for blessing. That becomes explicit in Abraham. But it also becomes explicit that God is going to pull a certain people out of a special him. And that people comes under a specific covenant under Moses.
Right.
In both Gentiles that are in the world during Abraham's time and afterwards, they're saved by believing in God, and he is a rewarder of those who seek him. So if you seek him and have a longing for the truth and for God, and you have a love for God, you come into the faith of Abraham and are saved. And that's true for both the Gentile in Abraham's day and the Jew in Moses' day. They fall into that common element of eternal salvation and love of God that's common to both thieves. But the Jews are privy to a special covenant that has to do with the land, the blessings, right, and those sorts of things.
Exactly.
And so it seems to like it takes the element of covenant very seriously out there. And that's why when you get down to Galatians, I've always been very confused about the fact that Paul says, you know, in Romans, the law is holy and good, if used lawfully, and, you know, and the law is from God. And then, you know, he turns around to Galatians and says, but if you're circumcised, it's of no benefit to you. You know, you're fallen from grace. And you're like, well, Paul, what are you saying? You know, it sounds like on one hand you're saying that the law is great, but then you come to the Gentiles and say it's not for you, you know. And it's just very confusing. But I think if you take that element of covenant, that Paul can come to the, basically he has two issues. One is, if Jews deny grace by saying you're saved by your worthiness of following the law, then you misunderstood Old Testament Judaism, because that's not what it was about.
Exactly.
So you messed up your Judaism. But secondly, if you as a Jew say to a Gentile, you have to keep the practices of the covenant of Moses, you know, to be acceptable in God's sight, you know, Paul has a problem with that too. So he has had two issues in Galatians. One is, you know, saving yourself by works, which isn't true, or imposing Mosaic covenant that's specific to Israel on the Gentiles.
Exactly.
And which are, so he has two issues there with them, and so it makes sense. Why does Paul not have the Gentiles, you know, practice circumcision? Well, because that's a special covenant with Moses, you know, and not with the Gentiles, you know. But is he opposed to the law? No. I mean, that's something that's still right and good in God's sight, and it's okay for the Jews to practice that. And that's why he says to Titus, who's a Gentile, don't be circumcised. And he says to Timothy, well, it's good if you're circumcised. You know, you can now fellowship with the Jews and be acceptable, you know, under the covenant they have, and those sorts of things. So I really think there's something to what you're saying that makes sense to a lot of what mm-hmm. I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, even your argument about Abraham is exactly the argument Paul makes in Romans 4, that Abraham is the father of both Gentiles and Jews. All you have to do is believe in the same way that your father Abraham did. And then what I've noticed in recent years is in Romans 10, it gets obscured because we translate it in our Bibles differently. But the more I understand what he's arguing in Romans 10, what he's saying is there was a justifiedness that comes from law. There is a way of being rendered to chaos before God by the law. And then he adds, but it just comes down to the same thing as faith. So he's not, that's where he's not a dispensationalist. You know, he's not saying that the Old Testament was one way of achieving righteousness, and now we have another way of achieving righteousness. He said they had the same way of achieving righteousness back there under the law. It's been faith all along. And that's more echoes of covenant theology. Yeah, that's fine.
You mentioned that Jews don't necessarily have to be biological descendants or whatever. Is there anything that would stop you, for example, from becoming a Jew? I mean,
no.
Aside from happy enough to grow up here.
Except I don't have a religious bone in my body. But other than that,
can anybody literally become a Jew if they were?
Yeah, and there's always been provision for that. A Gentile who wanted to become a Jew, if they were a male, they'd have to be circumcised. Mm-hmm. They'd go through a baptism ritual and offer a certain prescribed offering, and whiz bang, they're a Jew.
So, to what extent do they have to keep the law today? I mean, would they have to stone someone? I'm just wondering how much of the law.
Okay, you raise a great question. Why was Paul. Why was Paul at such liberty to disregard keeping the law when he went out to be with the Gentiles and evangelize? Remember, he says in 1 Corinthians, when I'm with the Gentiles, I become as a Gentile in order that I might win some. Why did he feel the freedom to do that? Well, I would argue that in large part, the reason he felt the freedom to do that is because Paul recognized what was true all along, and that is, the covenant that God made with Israel is only a covenant that can be kept by a nation. An individual can't keep the covenant. I mean, just there's too many provisions in the covenant that would be out of the control of an individual Jew. So either you all sign up for it and do it, or it doesn't get done.
Which is why people have to be stoned, literally.
Sorry?
Which is why people had to be stoned.
Yeah, I mean, that if they started to not keep the covenant, then you stoned them and made sure that everyone alive was on board with keeping this covenant. But Paul recognized that his people had rejected God and were just not in a place where they were ready to do the covenant. So it wasn't something that he could take on himself. He recognized that it was just going to have to happen later on in history. Now, he respected his religion, and so whenever he was at liberty to do so, and there weren't other priorities, he practiced his religion and the traditions of his fathers. But he felt free to set them aside in a heartbeat if he needed to in order to proclaim the gospel to some Gentile. But I think part of the reason that he could do that is because when this all goes down and when this finally happens, it's going to be the whole nation that takes it on. It's not something that can happen gradually. You know, just I'm going to keep it until somebody else starts joining me and then somebody else starts joining me, because it's too interconnected. All of your institutions have to be done in a certain way. Your judicial system has to be done in a certain way. I mean, all that stuff has to be in place or you're not keeping the covenant.
So, if a Gentile were today to become a Jew, and obviously the nation of Israel is keeping the covenant, would all those punishments of God then apply to that Gentile as well?
Okay. Well, if a Gentile today were to become a Jew, I don't know how that would happen. I mean, I don't know how that could happen, because the Judaism of today is not Judaism. So why would you become a Judaism that's not Judaism?
Right.
I mean, I don't see any incentive there for a Christian believer, for example, someone who actually takes this seriously, to take on, say, Orthodox Judaism today, or Reform Judaism, or the more liberal forms of Judaism would make no sense for us to take on at all. The only thing that would make sense would be Orthodox Judaism, on the assumption that it really truly is biblical Judaism. But Orthodox Judaism is not biblical Judaism. What's going to have to happen somehow, somewhere in history, in the hearts of the Jewish people, is they're going to have to rethink how they read their Bible. Because what's happened is, just as had already happened in the time of Jesus, they gave more heed to the tradition of the elders than they did to the scriptures. Well, that's what makes rabbinic Judaism rabbinic Judaism, and all of modern Judaism is rabbinic Judaism. What makes rabbinic Judaism rabbinic Judaism is that you give heed to the traditions passed down from rabbi to rabbi to rabbi to rabbi, and it is completely untethered from the scripture. I mean, they just make junk up. And because it's a part of their tradition, a very sacred part of their tradition, you know, they hold it, they keep it, they memorize it, they think in terms of it, they revere it, but there's no connection between the actual revelation of God in what we call the Old Testament scriptures, what they call Torah. There's no actual resemblance between what Torah really is saying on the one hand and what they believe. And most, even Orthodox Jews, are biblically illiterate. They don't read their Torah.
But they
don't study their Torah. Sorry?
But they know the Talmud.
Yeah, but they know Talmud. Yeah.
Would it be analogous to what happened with Christianity and, say, the papal writings?
Yes. Yeah, very, very similar. The history of Christianity parallels the history of Judaism in that very, very quickly Christianity started to throw the authority off of the Bible and onto Christian tradition. Exactly. And so, yeah, Christianity suffers the same problems that Judaism does.
Including not reading our Bibles.
Including not reading our Bibles, exactly. Or to the extent that we read them, we don't study them to know what they say. We already know what they say, so we read them to have it confirmed, what we already believe. But the thought that I would actually be challenged by what I'm reading to rethink and to adjust my thinking, I mean, that's really foreign to the way most Christians operate. But until that happens within Judaism, their own scriptures are going to be a closed book to them. I mean, I think that's, if you want to hurry history along, that's the project you need to take on. Convince Judaism that they have been hermeneutically mistaken for thousands of years. But I think that's what's going to happen.
How do you think that would happen?
How?
Yeah, well, we'll get that ball rolling.
We could start a separate program at Gutenberg. Strange.
Well, I would love to have a dialogue with some rabbis.
So you're going to start it?
I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to see, because I just doubt. I mean, it is such a strong, long established tradition that they are a part of, that it would take an incredible amount of courage and humility on the part of a rabbi to say, "Wow, we've been thinking about this wrong." I mean, it's almost unthinkable.
Do you see any signs of it? Do you hear any murmurings?
Well, what I do see are signs of spiritual activity among Orthodox Jews, and that's what gives me hope. I mean, I think probably throughout their history there have been believing Jews who are sanctified children of God, just like you and I. They've never acknowledged Jesus. They've never recognized Jesus. They live in a tradition that's kept that from them and kept them trapped from being able to go there. But I don't think that means that the Spirit of God has not been working in them to sanctify them. I think He has. And I do think that you're beginning to see more and more, especially among Orthodox Jews, some of the most thoughtful social political commentators in our nation right now are Orthodox Jews. And that's interesting. I mean, what's going on there? Because they're seeing things, that they recognize the need. Did you hear Rabbi Lapin when he was here at all? He's an Orthodox Jew. We had him speak at a conference here a few years back. And it's a very simple, and it's so simple that I think, well, why didn't I think about that? Why didn't I think of it? But it's profoundly true. He was looking at the various, they tend to be leftist liberal causes, but the leftist liberal causes that you have out there in social political America, it's very, 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 very important that we don't bash in the heads of baby seals. But I'll be damned if I don't have the right to bash in the head of my unborn child. I mean, you go right down the line, just a series after series of what looked like incredible contradictions. How can you be for saving the baby seals and for abortion? How can you be, and I can't remember all of the dichotomies that he listed, but the thing that seems so, they just seem on principle to be self-contradictory. I mean, either you're for little creatures not having their heads bashed in, or you're not for it. I mean, what's consistent here? And what he argued is that the strange consistency is our liberal, our social political agenda seems to be driven by finding some way to be against God. We're defying God at every turn that we take, and that's the only place you're going to find the unity in the social political landscape today, is that our hostility toward God is driving our politics. And I think that makes a lot of sense the more I look around. And the emphasis on what the Orthodox Jews are seeing is the collapse of morality in our culture. But I don't think they see grace yet. That'll be the real insight, is when they recognize the grace and mercy of God.
But is that because they don't? Do you think that? I mean, that assumes that they have a profound understanding of sin.
Yeah, and I good point. I don't think they see that yet either. I was shocked when Rabbi Lappin said that they don't believe in hell. I mean, it's not shocked that they don't believe in hell, but any sort of eternal condemnation. And I said, well, what do you think happens to the people who haven't believed? Well, they get scolded before they are led into the kingdom of God. I think there's a shallow view of sin there that thinks I'm going to get a tongue lashing for who I am. But, you know, maybe I'm wrong, but somehow that doesn't seem to be right. If Jesus had to die for my sins, but all I'd have to get is a tongue lashing, there's something amiss there.
It sounds like you suggest, when you say that they have to follow this as a nation, it all has to be there, then how does it come gradually?
I'm saying I don't think it can. I don't think it will.
Whatever comes is going to have to come almost supernaturally.
Yeah, it's at a decisive break in their history, and it seems to be related to the great and terrible day of the Lord, which, as best I can understand it, I think they're going to be on the brink of being annihilated by an invading army of some kind. And remember, I'm making this stuff up. But the picture that seems to make sense to me is that some prophetic figure will say, go to such and such a place in Israel and God will protect you. And the people of Israel are going to split into two groups, the people who believe the prophet and go to that location and the people who try to escape. The people who try to escape are going to be killed. And the people who go and obey the instructions of the prophet are spared, and the whole nation is spared supernaturally by God.
And then they will see the light.
And that people then will reconstitute themselves, the people of God, I think.
This client, if Satan is in the abyss now, I followed your logic. But you're blowing my mind. All the other stuff too. Why do we have to put on the armor of God to protect ourselves from the arrows of Satan? Why does Paul, I think, in Corinthians say we are aware of the schemes of Satan? Satan is behind every corner, crouching like a lion.
Is he behind every corner?
First.
Well, Peter says that the devil is like a roaring lion.
There you go. Thank you.
I think we say he's behind every corner.
I'm making it up too.
Okay.
But, So if he's in the abyss...
Right. Now, that's a good question. Because I think that being locked in the abyss is just a picture, a metaphor of the relative inactivity of Satan, but it's not an absolute inactivity. So I think Satan is still active in the world. He's still telling lies and deceiving and doing his thing. But by comparison to the reign he had to deceive the world before Jesus came into the world, less effectiveness, something like that, because there's more light to dispel the darkness. I think that's what the picture is trying to picture. But you're absolutely right. It's not as if Satan is not continuing to be active and effective in the world, because he clearly is.
So how is the world more enlightened now than before Christ? I don't see that.
Well... What's astonishing to me is notice how polytheism died out after Christ, after Christianity came on the scene. That's astonishing, really. I mean, you couldn't find somebody who was not a polytheist before Jesus. And all of a sudden, Jesus comes on the scene, and the whole intellectual map of Western civilization is transformed by this teacher who had something different to say. Well, that's an astonishing transformation. I have to wonder if by deceiving the nations, like if you went into a temple built by Zeus, if that stone god didn't talk to you, if you're a priest of Zeus, making polytheism incredibly plausible. If stone figures of a god talk to you, then it's plausible to believe that that is a locus of the power of that god. I can't remember the last time a stone statue talked to me, so polytheism just doesn't seem plausible to me. Not at all.
I've heard you mention that possibility before about idol speaking, but I haven't seen anything in the Old Testament that would suggest that.
Yeah, there's no evidence of that in particular. It's just my speculation on what is it about their experience that made that believable in a way that it's so unbelievable to us today. But if I'm right, then the fact that you would have demonic activity that would deceive people, trick people into these weird worldviews through their trickery and through their deception and deceit, could be part of the greater darkness of the ancient world. That's what I'm suggesting. But yeah, I'm totally speculating. I don't really have evidence of that. Not exactly. Although, you know, you read Plato's dialogues and they believed that they were hearing the oracle at Delphi. Could be that they were imagining that on the one hand. On the other hand, maybe somebody was speaking. So they believed they were hearing. And so either no, they weren't, they were making it up, or were self-deceived, or somebody else was deceiving them. And notice there's this statement that Jesus makes. It's right after, let's see, isn't it right after they have accused him of being Beelzebul, the prince of demons? It's by the power of Beelzebul that he casts out demons. I think it's in that context. He goes on to say, unless a stronger man comes in and binds a strong man, he cannot steal his possessions. And what he's doing is he's trying to make plausible to the Pharisees, why is it that me and my disciples are casting out demons? Well, the demons have a grip, the powers of evil, the forces of evil in the world have a grip on the minds and hearts of people. We have to loosen their grip in order for me to be able to bring people into God's possession. To steal them away from Satan, we need to loosen their grip on them. And he describes this: the thief breaks in and binds the strong man, I think. Well, I think that's the same imagery as being put into the abyss, imprisoned in the abyss, is an imagery of him being kind of kept from having the same level of effect and activity that he had before. If I'm right about that, it would not surprise me if, when at the end of this time, if the kind of demonic activity that Jesus was confronting when he was casting out demons doesn't return. That would not surprise me. Because if that goes hand in hand with the power of Satan being bound, then when he's unbound, presumably that will return. Pray the light linger.
You said that right now, from 70 AD on, the Jews, when they're in tribulation, isn't that where Satan's like chasing them and doing stuff?
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't that be more power?
No. Because, see, I think all of these things are just images and metaphors, pictures that explain the truth in part. But I think if you take any of these pictures and try to turn them into an absolute reality, it doesn't fit. It doesn't work. So, yes, he's imprisoned in the abyss such that his activity has been, it's been curtailed, it's been limited. So he doesn't have the same level of power and freedom that he had before, but he's not without power and not without freedom to try to accomplish his deceptive, destructive purposes. So yes, he's been in the world seeking to destroy the Jewish people, I think.
Okay. And he hasn't necessarily been restrained from deceiving the Jewish people, but he has been restrained especially towards the Gentiles, those who were followers of Paul. Jews have remained in the hardness of heart.
Right.
Paul says, he tells the Gentiles, he brought it fully, so it seems like there's kind of a dual-sided, emphasis of Satan on the Jewish people.
Yeah, he calls it a partial hardening has come upon the Jewish people.
Okay, my other question is, what's the nature of the kingdom ruled by Judas, where the Jews are citizens in it? They say Gentiles won't be. That's before the world ends?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then after the world ends, level playing field?
Yeah, you could put it that way. Very level playing field. Yeah, exactly.
So that's what we're waiting for? That's. I mean, from what you're saying, it sounds like we might or might not be. I mean, like, that's at some point we're just off on the side. I mean, and so the Jews could reconstitute while Gentiles are around.
If I'm right, what's going to happen is any Gentiles who are believers, when the darkness begins to descend, are either going to get killed, die of old age, or maybe it may very well be that the only place left on the earth for a believer to run for refuge is to Israel. So we may, even though we're Gentiles, we may find no other safe haven except there. But I don't think there are going to be many left, because if, just like what is exactly what John was saying, is that Paul describes what has happened among the Jewish people for the last 2,000 years. A blindness has come upon them, a hardening of their heart has come upon them. But that's going to be lifted when Paul says, when the time of the Gentiles is full. Well, what does he mean by that? I think what he means by that is when God is done taking from among the Gentile people to be his own, he will stop working among the Gentiles and he will now turn back to his own people, the Jews, to begin to sanctify them and draw them to himself. Well, when that day comes that he shifts his focus back onto Israel, there just ain't going to be Gentiles becoming believers any longer.
That's not as an absolute either. Just like today, there are Jews who believe.
Right.
It's just that you don't characterize their generations being believers.
Right.
The same way, there's a certain sense in which we characterize Western civilization as being Christian, even if only in name, even if only the intellectual inheritance of Christianity has come upon them. There's still the sense of being consensus around certain values that are Christian. Because there are true believers that make a proportion of society which kind of colors all that.
So just as there is a remnant of Jews today who actually do believe, there will probably always be a remnant of Gentiles. But it's that remnant that are probably going to have to flee to Israel for safe haven, because they'll meet nothing but hostility anywhere else in the world, probably. I'm really making this stuff up. Okay. So we'll look at Jesus next week, the titles of Jesus and what all that stuff means. And thank you.